Welcome, everyone, to the Our Strange Skies podcast. I am your host, Rob Christofferson, and I'm joined today by Adam Gorightly. And Adam has written a number of books, including Happy Trails to High Weirdness, The Prankster, and The Conspiracy. And one of the best books about the disinformation age in the UFO community, and that is Saucer Spooks and Kooks, the book that we're talking about today. So, Adam, welcome to the podcast, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on. So first things first, like there have been a number of books written about the Dulce Base conspiracy, the Benowitz affair and stuff. So I'm curious, what caused you to dip your toes into this and write a book about this particular subject?
Yeah, as I kind of explain in the book, my interests, I mean, I was aware of Dulce stories over the years, but my interest really got focused, around 2007, 2008, when I met Tal Levesque, started communicating with him, and there's quite a bit of a story how I got in touch with him, and we started we had a couple meetings and a lot of correspondence over the years. And Tal claimed that he was a key player in the Dulce Base story, promoting it back in the day in the late 80s. And, he stressed that to me a number of times, that he was the key one that really got that story rolling. And the more I looked into it, I found that, that was pretty accurate to a certain extent, that he was one of the key players back in the day, along with John Lear was another one that helped promote the Dulce Base mythos. So my original plan, when I met Tal, was like a 10,000 word essay called My Breakfast with Tal, and kind of expanded, though, because I started looking into the Dulce Base mythos to really find out what was fact, what was fiction, and so that kind of spurred me to really getting deep into the weeds about Dulce. And over time, it became pretty evident that Dulce basically came out of the Benowitz affair. And once you start digging into that, that leads to all kinds of other threads and connects back to the whole Roswell incident and the MJ-12 papers. They were all connected to the Benowitz affair. And a lot of these stories all seem to be wrapped up into each other, along with Area 51, etc. They all use some of the same playbooks. A lot of the same players are involved in promoting these stories over the years.
Yeah, so, and oh yeah, no, go ahead.
No, that was it.
Okay. So I'm curious, because like a lot of this stuff, if we go back even before the Benowitz stuff really starts to become prominent in the disinfo, it kind of really starts with Roswell. Mm-hmm. and not just Roswell, but with Leonard Stringfield got into, like, he devoted most of the rest of his career in ufology to these like crash retrieval status update reports and stuff. Like, there's just, right, I think 6 volumes of them or something like that. So I'm curious, do you think all of this came from like the same kind of disinformation kind of like plan, or do you think like this, the entire thing was like contained to like smaller groups? Because it seemed in many ways like Doty, with the Benowitz stuff, it almost seemed like he was acting on his own in many ways, or at least that's just kind of how it felt. But do you think this was part of a larger disinformation program by something else, you know?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
The original crash retrieval stories originated like in 1950 with the Aztec, the Frank Scholes book, right? I'm sure you're aware of all that. I think that was the first story. There might have been some earlier, and Roswell later, I think, was modeled after that. But in between that, yeah, we had Leonard Stringfield in the 70s who claimed that he had sources, information on all these other crash retrievals. There was quite a few other ones. I can't reel them all off the top of my head, but that is what he was claiming in the late 70s. And he kind of came to the attention to some observers because he was claiming he had classified or was leaking classified documents, and came up on the radar. Actually, Jack Brewer wrote about it on his blog about it was one of those late 70s, 78 MUFON around then, when an NSA asset, who I'm trying to remember who it was somebody within the MUFON scene, was reporting on Stringfield that he was making these claims of government involvement and cover up of these crash retrievals. Now, was this, part of the early disinformation campaign? I really don't know, but Bill Moore seemed to have picked up on that growing interest in the so-called crash retrievals, and might have been one of the motivations that led him to look into it more, and eventually come across information, him and Stan Friedman, on the so-called Roswell crash, and which led to his book, The Incident at Roswell, which really launched the whole mythos into the stratosphere.
And which is an interesting book because, like, Roswell doesn't necessarily play the biggest part in the book. Like, it's a lot of it has to do with the research into it, but there's like a lot of other filler information in that book, which is always, it's always interesting to me. Like, that became like the thing. And then, I think like Unsolved Mysteries did a lot to promote Roswell in like the public sphere and stuff like that. But, the crash angle has always been interesting to me because like it just seemed like those UFOs were just like crashing everywhere.
Yeah, that's what seems so absurd about it. It's like you had the technology to come all the way to multiple light years or whatever to come to Earth, and you end up crashing again and again and again.
Right.
And some of the common themes, in the early Scholes Aztec story, there's a lot of similarities to the
Yeah.
Roswell story. There was, like, as I recall, hieroglyphics of some sort on the craft, and they were little midget type guys, and there was a lot of similarities there. So it became, this meme trope that was entered into ufology, and it's still with us. I'm sure you're aware of Mr. Grush and his claims that the congressional hearing of hearings a few days ago.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
it, you know, it, if you trace this back just a few years to the whole TTSA thing, that was kind of at the core of some of the information they were putting out through different channels. Tom DeLonge claimed that he had information from whoever this was, Major McCaslin or something to that effect, who was at Wright-Patterson, that they had information on the Roswell crash, and they had, so-called remains. And, that's one of the other tropes that as is as constant as the crash retrieval, is that whatever you want to call it, the memory metals, metamaterials, this debris from these crafts is in the possession of the government, and they're suppressing us, suppressing it from us. It's covered up.
It's an epidemic that people are still fighting against, and I find the Aztec incident kind of the strange enduring power that that story has, because Scott Ramsey and Suzanne Ramsey have been all over that, wrote a book about it, and then it showed up in some like MJ-12 documents in 2017. It's
So are the Ramses. Tell me who they are in a nutshell. I think I know who they are, but they're actually true believers, right? Or are they?
yes, they
Okay.
are. Yeah, absolutely. And they kind of took Frank Scully's research and ran with it. And I think they've
Right.
talked to a few people and included it in their book. But it's just, I don't know what it is about that case that just like has that weird enduring mystery to it.
So it's interesting. I wasn't really familiar with the Ramses here until probably about a year ago or so. I was out in New Mexico, Farmington to be specific. And one of the places they claim, somebody claims the Aztec crash occurred was near Farmington. And a friend and I went out to a site that there's a marker there showing the spot. And I wasn't aware of that. I was asking my friend, well, where did you get this information from? He said, oh, I just got it online. I found there's a marker for the Azrael or the Aztec crash. And we went out to find it. And we couldn't find it. We eventually found the spot, but somebody had removed the monument. And as I dug into it more, I found out that the Ramses had put that monument out there, basically, I guess, to promote their book, but it's not out there anymore.
It's kind of incredible the people that want to put monuments up to their UFO encounters. There's that one Massachusetts encounter from the 60s that what the heck was is that one? It was featured on the new Unsolved Mysteries. But like I remember there being a controversy because where this event happened, they put a monument out there, and I guess the town was not did not approve it. So like if I recall, it was the History Channel that paid to have it put out there, and yeah, they had to have it removed.
I don't know if that happened in this situation. It's in a pretty remote, I mean, relatively remote area, I think near public land or, maybe the feds was on federal land and they removed it. But anyway, yeah, that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it's just like I don't know, something about that case, but
Oh, and just to touch on it a bit more, when you really look into the Aztec case, it was all basically perpetuated by a couple of grifters, Now, there's been multiple books that or different books that come out on Aztec, and I haven't really read any of them, but claimed they, it was more than just a grift. There was actually something to it, but how that goes.
Yeah, exactly. They're always definitely there are those like I don't know. There's just those kind of weird stories out there that just like somehow endure. And when it comes to in particular like the Dulce base story, why has that story endured so much? And even after Bill Moore in the 89 MUFON conference comes out, says, all of this stuff is crap. Why has this been one thing that has endured so long? Because I have had friends who literally say, I won't say Dulce, man, they'll come and get me. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, yeah, I mean, how many people at the time, that Bill Moore's admissions or whatever you want to call them, it's pretty a small group of people at the MUFON conference, you know, and the word got out over the years, and it kind of grew and grew about that conference. How it was legendary in a sense that, you know, basically kind of revealed what was going on with the Benowitz affair, but the general public weren't really aware of what was going on in ufology and other things, like, you know, I mentioned in the book, what you call it, the X-Files, you know, was something that really put a pushed it out into the public sphere. Some of these tropes and memes about Dulce, the underground bases, and, you know, the different experimentation that was going on there. Eventually, that got really pushed into the popular consciousness of culture, and that was really linked initially to the Dulce base stories that were coming out in the late 80s.
Yeah, and
That all that imagery that got ingrained to the imagination of, you know, generations growing up in the 90s, late 80s and 90s, once again through X-Files and other science fiction that was being, you know, promoted and released during that period, based on true stories,
Oh, yeah.
supposedly.
Supposedly, like, based on true stories that people have definitely added on to, which your book does a great job of highlighting that. And there was a video that I saw this morning, and it was Showtime is trying to capitalize on the UAP hearings. So they showed this video on TikTok of Richard Doty talking about the alien body that he says the government recovered, and he said, well, they called it EBA, and I'm like, no, you're it's EBE is what you're talking about. And it's amazing when you go back and you look at the X-Files how much of the Doty stuff actually made it in there, because like there is an episode titled EBE, based on the term that he introduced into the UFO community. It's very wild to me that this man has had such an enduring legacy, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on Doty and like this redemption arc that he has had for like the last 5 or 6 years. Like, why are people suddenly open to this man now? What is it that makes people want to talk to him?
Oh God, well, he's kind of a star on the scene, you know, and they go away for a while and make their comeback, and oh, that's Richard Doty, man. He was at the center of these stories back in the day. And you mentioned they asked him what the name was. It wasn't, like you noted, he didn't say EBE, he said Eben, EBEN. And that actually goes back to, you know, the early days when he and Bill Moore were working together. That's what they were calling it back in, you know, the early 80s. The entities were known as Ebens. Just a little fun factoid there. But yeah, why do I ask that question too? Why are people promoting Doty? You know, that's bizarre. Don't they know people aren't aware of the history, or they don't care? You know, it's one of that thing. If he basically confirms their biases of people who want to believe in the stuff he's promoting, then they will. And so, yeah. Doty's gone through different phases, you know. Really, initially, he got into, you know, by the mid to late 80s, got into a bit of trouble. And there's different stories what that exactly that trouble was, depending on who you talk to. And one film that's floating around that people aren't really aware of, that's out there if you look, has to do with it was released Yeah, it was released after he left the Air Force, which would have been 87-ish, 88. Recall, that footage of Falcon and UFO cover-up live, as far as I can tell, was filmed in the mid-80s. And of course, that was Doty. But that wasn't released until after he retired, which is kind of curious. But there was another filmed interview of Doty by, trying to remember the actual name. It was produced by Bill Moore and some others, and they had a God, I don't have the information here hand me, but they're a bit before me, but it was basically released as the time as a whistleblower tape where Doty was talking about his experiences at Kirtland Air Force Base. And of course, there wasn't really none of the Falcon revelations. There was the one revelation he was involved with these ships that were seen at Coyote Canyon that appeared to be the same craft Paul Benowitz was witnessing. But also in that this whistleblower film put out during that period through Bill Moore and some other folks, he claimed they asked him about Linda Howe and the claim she was making that he had shared this information about an alien in captivity and a lot of the information that came out of the Aquarius paper and the MJ-12 papers. And in this so-called whistleblower video, Doty claims that no, he didn't share any of that with her. It was Linda Howe that came to him with that information, which was kind of interesting because he contradicts that, of course, nowadays in later interviews that they were basically disinforming Howe with their famous meeting, like in the mid 80s, with her. And so anyway, there's been this long game that Doty's been involved with, constantly changing his story or moving the goalposts or, what makes him interesting, I guess, to some observers is that you can glean little pieces of factual information that's mixed up with all of the BS and misinformation and disinformation. And so, that's one of the reasons that I guess some researchers are still pursuing him and interested in what he has to say, hoping they can pull out some little tidbit that will help them, whatever, push the disclosure along or expose what's going on.
Yeah, and like he is I don't get it because like for at least for him it's like why because he's come up, he's come back a couple different times. Like he came back with, the Project Serpo stuff and about I want to say like 2018 he just started doing interviews. Like I know he's started appearing on Fade to Black and stuff like that. And I'm always curious as to whether, like, is this just a guy who wants to influence this community, or is there somebody behind him that wants him to influence this community? And it's like, well, who's really behind it? And why does he keep popping up? Is it a genuine love of this stuff, or does the man just love messing with people?
I think it's probably the latter, you know. Is he still involved in the government disinformation campaign? How much was he involved back in the Benowitz day? Certainly at the time the Benowitz affair was going on, the government wanted to find out what he knew, specifically Air Force intelligence and the NSA wanted to figure out what he knew, and they were happy if he got confused thinking it was aliens that he was observing. How much farther did Doty push that? I think As the question appears that Doty took it a bit further with a lot of the fake documents that started circulating that were being at Doty was putting out there and Bill Moore was involved with. I don't know if that was necessarily part of the government campaign, like the MJ-12 papers. That might have been more some extracurricular activities that Doty was involved with.
And
In
that's
fact,
another, yeah,
that's
no,
my
go.
suspicion, I don't know for
Yeah.
sure.
And I think the other aspect to all of this is Bill Moore himself and how much he actually like played a role in creating the information. Because it always seems like he's been portrayed as the guy who is just disseminating the information. But to me, it seems like he's had more of a hand in that, in creating the actual information that was disseminated out. Do you find yourself thinking the same way?
Yeah, if you look at the timeline, I mean, it takes a bit of effort to get all the different documents they were putting out back in the day, because there was a whole bunch of different documents that some people say should be looked at separately, but I think you need to look at all of them because they all appeared to be hoax documents. And they're all about different secret projects. And if you start putting these all together in like a timeline, you can see that early on there was this document called the Aquarius document that Benowitz was shown. And the story was that Moore had seen the original teletype of this Aquarius document. Then he saw a second one that Doty showed him that had been supposedly altered, and mentioned information about ETs. And Doty, according to how Moore told the story, Doty asked Moore to share that with Benowitz, basically to disinform him, hoping Benowitz would take that document and say, here's government information of, ET. Cover up of ETs and that they're here and there's, this invasion going on, et cetera, et cetera. In that early Aquarius document, and we're talking, this is like 81 or 82, and you can find this online. I've endeavored sometime, maybe thinking of putting all these together online and showing them, but it gets pretty damn confusing anytime you. For
Yeah.
me to try to do that. But anyway, in that early Aquarius document, there's a mention of Majestic 12, So this was a couple of years before the MJ-12 documents came out, which was kind of curious. And around that time, we're getting into, remember, the MJ-12 documents came out more like in 83. And prior to that, they were, that was the first time that Moore and Chandra, Jamie Chandra, saw those documents. Supposedly, the first time they would have heard about, been aware of this group called MJ-12, but that name was showing up in some of these earlier documents and around, 83, oddly enough, Moore was working with Bob Pratt. I don't know if you're familiar with that name. He was the UFO on the UFO desk at the National Enquirer, and he was looking in a lot of the same areas that Moore was looking into at that time. And they joined forces to write a book based on the experiences of Richard Doty, and different titles for that book was Majestic. I think they went originally with the called the book the Aquarius Project, So prior to the MJ-12 papers being released, all this was going on. And what the MJ-12 papers confirmed, basically, among other things, was the Roswell story, which, Bill Moore had a book published, in 1980. So there's a lot of curiosities there with the timelines, what was going on with Bill Moore and Doty's interactions and the release of all these different documents. Moore's explanation was that he was just working as an intermediary, that the Doty or the government or whoever would feed these documents, some which were maybe not classified. It wasn't clear, and in turn, Moore would pass some of these documents along and let him know what was going on with other researchers in the field.
Yeah. And even when Brad Sparks and Barry Greenwood came out with their analysis of these in 2007 at the MUFON symposium, they called them, I think, the secret Pratt tapes or something like that. But basically the same thing, just that, they've been crafting this narrative for a little bit longer, which is interesting when you think about it, because they're given these documents, it's like that kind of secret spy crap that you hear about where, something's mysteriously dropped off at your doorstep and it's, a roll of film, you get them developed and you have like these documents purporting, this Eisenhower crap, and it's interesting to me that we have the Pratt tape stuff. We have Bill Moore and Jamie kind of just like they're taking their time trying to authenticate the stuff, and Doty seems upset enough that he's willing to go to somebody else. So, he goes to Jenny Randles, and Jenny Randles doesn't want anything to do with it because she's been duped while investigating, I think, like the Rendlesham case or something like that. And then ultimately they land in Timothy Good's lap and he publishes them. But I, if I recall, Moore published them right before he did because, they kind of want, he wants the credit for it. Which is,
That was the story, but I'm
yeah.
not really clear on any of that either. Some of those documents that had been already leaked to other researchers, so it seemed like whoever Doty, Moore, whoever wanted to get that information out earlier, but people weren't biting because, for all they knew, it was classified information. Such there's a story of Lee Graham that he was one of the researchers, and it's not clear what documents different researchers were getting, because there was a whole batch of them on these different secret programs. They mentioned Project Aquarius, and a lot of those documents were bogus, but or all of them were, that Doty or whoever actually was behind these documents. But there was a real Aquarius program going on at the same time, so you can see where the this disinformation angle was going on, to put this false Aquarius information out there to maybe see if anybody had learned about the real Aquarius program. That's where it gets confusing as hell. But I wanted to mention about the what was interesting about those Pratt tapes, and I was saying how basically Doty will put out little tidbits of information sometimes that are important to the piecing this greater story together. And I think it was after he made his last comeback, which seemed to come after the New York Times story, around 2017, 2018, around there, he started showing up on Jimmy Church, for instance. And I heard the interview, at least some of it. And he had mentioned in that interview, he said, what originally attracted us to Bill Moore didn't have anything to do with the UFOs, but contacts he was having with Russians at the time, which was pretty intriguing. And if you look at kind of Bill Moore's history, he did have an interest. He had a some type of degree in Russian history. It's pretty much early on, before he even got involved in UFO research, and was in contact with these different, a couple different Russian researchers or journalists, you know. And so that might have been key to what was going on with Bill Moore. Didn't have as much to do with UFOs as it did with Russian contacts and with Russian nationals who were becoming involved with MUFON and other groups, you know.
He kind of felt like, in the way that I've read about him and in other books, is like he kind of felt like a superstar in the 80s. Like he was this guy that had a lot of renown in the UFO community for the work that he was doing. And
Oh,
then,
certainly he was, yeah.
and then, like, 89 rolls around, and like, I'm curious, like, I've always been curious what led him to turn and say, I've been involved in this, in disseminating disinformation, and I basically helped to ruin one man's life. And and I think what one thing that I didn't know until I read your book is that he actually continued some of his work even after he was kind of tried to basically exited the UFO community. He still
Well,
worked on.
that's what he said for a while, that he was still quietly working behind the scenes with Jamie Chandra into the late 80s and early 90s. And he even went on oh, what's God, I'm forgetting the guy's name, who was one of the editors at UFO Magazine. Too many names in my head. Don Ecker went on Don Ecker's show in like 92 or so, which was a big deal. B Bill Moore's back. Nobody'd really heard from him during that time period. I think he'd done an interview with my buddy Greg Bishop for the Excluded Middle, but here he shows up, and he was saying, "Soon I'll have a lot more to tell you." One of them thing he was going about in that interview in 92, he was they got into talking about the Benowitz affair and how J. Allen Hynek was much more involved with that than it's been previously known, and that he has documentations, an actual contract that Hynek had signed with the government that more sounded made sound kind of sinister, and I guess had to do with the story that Hynek allegedly was the middleman of handing off this computer they used to disinform and spy on Benowitz, basically make Benowitz, according to the story, think that he was able to communicate with the aliens during this during that period. And so he Moore made a pretty big stir on that episode of Don Eckers. I think it was called UFO UFOs Tonight radio show. And Ecker asked him, "Well, can you show me that actual documentation of that contract?" And he said, "Well, I don't have it with me, but you'll be seeing this information soon, and I will certainly share a copy with you." And then that was it. He basically disappeared again. One of the things he talked about on that show was the conference that happened in Colorado, Crestone Conference. He didn't have the name quite right, but what he was talking about was that Crestone Conference, where he claimed a lot of this, the whole Benowitz story got kind of hammered out, or how it was going to be presented by the public, by John Lear and some other folks. And that's another thing I started looking into and found out, indeed, that did happen during that period. And John Lear basically usurped Bill Moore for the mantle of, a big star in UFO. And that was part of the gripe in his MUFON speech, that John Lear had taken a lot of this Benowitz information and spun it to a new and crazier level. Like there was this invasion of Earth, and that there was these underground bases where they were abducting humans and doing experiments on them, and cattle mutilations were involved in this craziness. So, according to Moore, that was part of his motivation for that, his MUFON speech, was to expose that John Lear was putting out disinformation and crazy stories. And he also name checked Linda Moulton Howe, that she had been sucked into that web of disinformation. He doesn't name Howe by name in his speech, but it's obvious who he's talking about when it, top cattle mutilation researcher.
Yep.
And a lot of people knew going into that MUFON speech that something was up with Bill Moore, and that they'd gotten wind of it. I know Linda Moulton Howe had, according to Chris Lambright, told me he was there at the speech, and he was waiting outside the door with Linda Howe when Moore was walking in. And, Hal got into his face and, said something. Well, I hear you're calling me crazy or an idiot. He said, no. What I'm saying is you are a useful idiot. Then he walked right in and gave his speech. And so, I mean, what he was saying there was that she, Hal was one of the key people that were disinformed about the Benowitz story and Cash Landrum, et cetera. And she was still promoting those stories at the time, continues to this day. That's another odd thing about Doty, that he obviously fed her disinformation, and he is acknowledged as much, but she still believes what he presented to her about, once again, the MJ-12 papers, type information, secret, secret government projects, alien cat in captivities, et cetera, that, all of that information was true. And she still promotes it that way to this day.
She's talking about Bigfoot ripping cats in half and stuff like that. And like,
I hadn't heard about that, but yeah.
oh yeah, there's a whole thing about it's called the half cat phenomenon. It's interesting. But
So Bigfoot's going around and ripping cats in half.
that's her theory.
That's not good. I'm a big cats fan, so.
I am too. We actually did an episode about it. My friend Spencer tried to dive into like where this theory comes from, and yeah, it was a crazy episode, but it is one thing. They actually went to, I think it was like a Mile High Mysteries conference that she was there with David Politis,
Oh,
who
God.
is not a person I'm a fan of, but she was basically talking. She basically said Bigfoots are ripping cats in half, and promoted this theory. And the thing is like, when you look at Linda Moulton Howe, is this just a woman in denial that she was fucked with by somebody? Like,
I probably think so, from seeing interviews with her. She gets really defensive anytime anybody questions her on a lot of specific things.
Yeah, and I mean,
I mean,
she
way overly defensive. It seems like it's getting worse as time goes by, you know.
And I mean, like, she was definitely doing some, like, when she made the film in Alien Harvest, she was she kind of exploited Judy Doherty to an extent, promising her a bunch of stuff and like using her footage for the film, and then like just like there's nothing I can do to help you. But that's always the vibe that I got, especially after watching Mirage Men, like when she was confronted with the disinformation. Is like, no, nah, I don't, like complete and total denial of all the stuff that she has been through.
Yeah, let me mention this. She, when they had the 79 cattle mutilation conference, where a lot of this information started breaking through, you know, Gabe Valdez and others were at that conference. She wasn't there. My friend David Perkins was, and he was like one of the lead dudes. He was the keynote speaker for that thing. Him and Tom Adams were like really some of the key cattle mutilation researchers that time, and he'd done a lot of on the grounds field research there in New Mexico, Colorado, etc. And it was after that conference that Linda Howe got interested in the topic and contacted him, and he basically met with her several times, took all her files. It was like, yeah, whatever you want, I can help. And actually took her out to meet all his contacts. And those are a lot of the people you see in the film. And in the original film, you'll actually see Perkins in a couple of segments. And nowadays, if you look at the footage of Strange Harvest, David Perkins isn't in it. All that material's been removed.
Which is interesting, like
Yeah.
and like David in his own right, he's a legend in that field. He's been doing it for what, almost 50 years at this point. So
Yeah.
like, yeah, which is incredible. I mean, even listening to a couple of interviews that he's done in the last few years, and like he still keeps up with it, whenever there's like the new
Oh, he does.
mutilation. Yeah.
He does totally, yeah.
Yeah,
But
absolutely.
he was a great help to me with my book, and he wrote the foreword. And I had when I was I thought I was like to a point where I was wrapping up the book, and then I caught wind of Perkins' involvement, and I contacted him, and it was like, well, we really got into some in-depth conversations, and I shared the manuscript. And at that point, he kind of dove in and was like fact-checking me and say, you know, you ought to check out this or that. And so his input ultimately ended up the book being a lot better, and maybe taking another year to finish up because he added so much information. He just decided to jump in and totally give his support 100%. And that's how he is with any researchers, really, that he's constantly helping out folks like that.
Yeah,
Just
he
because
is.
he has this genuine interest and curiosity about the subject, and he's still trying to figure out them damn cattle mutes, what's going on with them.
And he has like, he ascribes to one of the more interesting theories behind it, which is, the Gaia theory, and which, if you listen to him expound upon it, it is a fascinating to think of, because like, as opposed to the UFO crash phenomenon, which just like the Southwest is just littered with UFOs at this point. There's like so many of them that people are bringing up, as opposed to the cattle mutilation phenomenon, where there is like, if there is human intervention. There is like zero error at this point because nobody's really ever been caught doing it. So like yeah, his theories are on that are very fascinating. Yeah, it's just he genuinely seems like one of the kindest people in this field doing this stuff today. So yeah, I can't say enough nice things about him.
I
So
concur, he's a good dude.
yeah, he really is. So your book had me thinking about one particular aspect, and it's the Myrna Hansen aspect of all of this, because she's one of the key players that kind of steers Paul Benowitz in the direction that he goes in. You know, the stuff that's been happening around Kirtland, I believe by the time that he met her. But I've always been curious, was Myrna Hansen part of the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, or was she just like this poor woman who went through something? And I'm curious to get your thoughts on that, because like you definitely presented as if she could have been part of the disinformation herself.
Well, she might have been. That's what Greg Valdez suspects when I was talking to him when I was researching the book. I mean, she, if you look at the timeline, so Benowitz in late 79, it's kind of around Christmas, where he initially what he were was seeing with basically just lights and things over the Kirtland Air Force Base in that Monsanto weapons storage area, which is a underground facility. You know, that's part of the story. I think a lot of this mythos about underground bases comes from, but initially he was filming and taking, you know, photographs of all these lights around there, and then he started capturing signals and whatnot, and that's when he came to the attention of AFOSI, because he went to them saying, you know, I'm filming this weird stuff and capturing these signals, finding out what's going on. I wanted to make you guys aware, because this could be a national security problem. So that was in late 79, early 80. And that's when Doty first kind of popped up. Well, let's not qu go there yet, but in May is when the Myrna Hansen, May of 1980, is when she showed up. So they might have very well at that point been trying to direct his attention away from Kirtland Base towards someplace else. And as others have theorized, that someplace else was Dulce, New Mexico, and the so-called Dulce Base. And so Myrna Hansen comes into the story, and it was through Gabe Valdez that Benowitz was introduced to Myrna Hansen. And you know, that would bring into question, well, was Gabe Valdez part of this? If Myrna Hansen was I don't know, I doubt that. But anyway, her experience was basically on early May of 1980. She and her son were in Cimarron, New Mexico, or Eagle Nest. One of the it was, she was from Eagle Nest, but it was around Cimarron. She was driving and saw this UFO that sucked the cattle up into it, and she was herself and her son were abducted, and she was transported to Benowitz, because the cops there in Cimarron first contacted Gabe Valdez. They didn't know how to deal with this hysterical lady making these claims, and Gabe Valdez got involved and took Myrna Hansen to Paul Benowitz, because Benowitz had contacts with APRO, the UFO organization, and they were dealing with some of these emerging abductees like Myrna Hansen, really, and the one before her was Judy Doherty, who seemed to have a similar experience. And they were, let's see, Leo Sprinkle was the guy doing the regressions for these. So Leo Sprinkle got brought into it, who had done the Judy Doherty regression that showed up in an Alien Harvest. And Doherty's similar story is quite similar to Myrna Hansen. It's like, was Myrna Hansen basically modeled after Judy Doherty? Originally, Judy Doherty, I mean, it's presented she saw cattle's being mutilated or whatever, but the original story was a cat. Cats come back into the story, and somehow that maybe moved on and got morphed and got conflated with these the whole cattle mutilation thing. But so anyway, Myrna Hansen ends up at Paul Benowitz's house, and by this time we've gone from late 79, where he was just starting to film these things and figuring them out, to by the time Myrna Hansen shows up in May, he's convinced that these are aliens that are behind all of this stuff, and they're beaming his house and beaming Myrna Hansen. They're trying to basically prevent him from finding out the true story, and they started doing these regressions. And he not only did he cover his car in tinfoil to keep the aliens supposedly from interfering with the reset these regressions, but he also had a device he had created this time that could thwart the ETs, that could he was on the cusp of creating some type of ray gun that would combat them. All this was going on. He had Myrna Hansen. Basically, I'm not sure how long she was there, but it was at least 2 or 3 weeks. And Benowitz's wife as well was being affected. According to Benowitz recordings I've heard, she was not. His wife was knocked to the ground. She was experienced some of these same effects that Myrna Hansen was supposedly experiencing. I think even Myrna Hansen's mom was there, and their son Sean. And anyway, through these regressions that were going on, it Benowitz learned that Myrna Hansen had been, during her abductions, and perhaps there was multiple by now, she had been transported to an underground base where the aliens had done experimentations on her, and that cattle mutilations once again were involved in this, and that she at one point had broken free of her alien captors and were wandering around this alien base and saw the classic vats with some type of human alien hybrids in them. As far as Myrna Hansen, after that she disappeared. I mean, she's never done interviews. Bill Moore said she moved to California. I could never really find any information on her, and not sure anybody ever did. And I guess, her perspective would be she didn't want to talk about all this crazy stuff. But Krista Tilton claims that Myrna Hansen contacted her in 1988, and Tilton as well claimed the same experiences as Myrna Hansen did in her book. Called she put out this booklet on Paul Benowitz. I'm forgetting the exact
I think it was
title,
called
but
the Benowitz Papers or something like
yep,
that.
there you got it. And she praises Richard Doty in this book, and so some people have seen Krista Tilton like in a similar role, maybe that she was involved in this greater operation. So who was Myrna Hansen? Did she really exist? Were they using an alias for her? I I don't know. She's a mysterious figure, and currently, that's where the story gets just so muddled because Benowitz started working with, let's see, what was Hynek's organization?
UFOs.
Yeah, MUFOS, and they also had contacts with the government, and they had taken Myrna Hansen because Benowitz believed she had something implanted in, like, at the base of her neck or in her head.
Yep.
Something had been implanted, so they went and did X-rays or something there, some type of scans. But it was to an underground facility as well, where, according to Doty or other people involved in the stories, where Air Force psychiatrists who put her under a regression. So this all gets muddled up with the Dulce base story as well, in the underground base story there. So it's not, and of course we have, Benowitz or Doty feeding information into this, so it all gets incredibly muddled and confused, and maybe, that's the whole intent. It would be interesting to really prove one way or the other who Myrna Hansen was. Was she an operative? Was that really her name,
And I think the interesting thing is here is that when it comes to Leo Sprinkle is the guy that somehow did regressive hypnosis on the three people that have claimed to have witnessed themselves being abducted along with their cattle. And Judy Doherty and Myrna Hansen are the two, but the one person that doesn't get brought up, and because of, like, I don't know, he kind of just became an obscure figure, is Pat McGuire. And I think, like, Pat McGuire kind of plays, he doesn't play a direct role in the story, but I think, he fits in that similar vein of around the time period when he came forward with the story, and that, he went through this regressive hypnosis with Leo Sprinkle and started talking about, being abducted with cows, and that the aliens need the cows for something. But he's always been kind of one of those, like, figures on the side that I think, while he doesn't play a direct role, he does have a so he fits into it somehow in some way.
I'm kind of familiar with that name. So he was interviewed around the same time as Judy Doherty. Is that?
His story gained a little attention in 81. He appeared on, I think it was NBC's That's Incredible or something like that. Went through hypnosis on television and received some notoriety, and it kind of went south for him after that. He had gone through regressive hypnosis with Leo Sprinkle, I think, in 79, somewhere around there.
Okay. Yeah, part of the going back to A Strange Harvest, the footage of David Perkins that you won't see anymore. He's shown in the film talking about this map he had put together, and he'd shown this at the cattle mutilation conference as well, where he was overlapping cattle mutes with areas where there was nuclear testing going on, or potential radiation or fallout, from all this testing. So he had put this together and was try kind of correlating it, was there this connection? And then and he had mentioned that to Leo Sprinkle. He was doing this research prior to Sprinkle starting to interview Judy Doherty, and later from different Judy Doherty interviews, one of them comes up. She starts talking about this, how nuclear radiation is connected with the cattle mutes. And Perkins got suspicious. Well, maybe Sprinkle was influencing her some way, maybe intentionally or unintentionally leading her. Somehow she got that into her head. And so it might have been the same, similar with the Cattle story itself, because once again, according to Perkins, her original telling of the story was that it was a cat that got mutilated.
And then the story changed over time. I think the interesting thing about Judy Doherty, and I've had some help in because I'm doing an episode on Pat McGuire soon.
Oh, okay.
I was given a bunch of stuff from Leo Sprinkle's papers that are being stored, I think, at the University of Wyoming or something like that. And there is a letter from Judy Doherty to Leo Sprinkle in which she talks about she gets these premonitions that AIDS is being transmitted through feces and water. It's a wild letter that I stumbled across in there, and it's like,
Wow.
and I know that I know Judy struggled for years because she finally kind of came out fully with her story in like was it like the mid 2000s or something like that. She had a kind of an online press conference kind of thing where she put her story out there, but yeah, that was one of the weirdest tidbits about her experiences, if you want to say that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was sort of a weird letter. So
Hey, I had heard about those Leo Sprinkle archives that and they're where at the University of Wyoming?
I think so. I've got a friend in Wyoming right now,
What
who
I'm
lives.
curious about, and seems like I looked into this a little bit. I'm not sure how far I got, but I was wondering it. In any of those papers, if there was Myrna Hansen information.
I didn't see any, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't anything there. And like the way that they have his stuff broken down is kind of confusing when you look at the boxes online and the way that they have it
Yeah,
broken down. It's very confusing.
I think I was looking at that and I didn't see anything right offhand, but and there could be the possibility that that was an alias they were using, Myrna Hansen. She might have another name. So that's, yeah, something to keep in mind if you get access to that, some of that stuff.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely keep that in mind. If I find anything, I will pass it your way. So speaking of people that may or may not exist, Tom Costello, was he real or was he not?
No, he's not real. And as I say in the book, I think it was a composite character that was created based on Tal Levesque himself and Paul Benowitz. It's pretty, it seemed pretty, there's a good chance of that in my mind when I put the timeline together of the legend of Tom Costello and put a timeline of what Tal said he was doing during similar years. There was a kind of similar work history there. He's always called there's shorthand in a lot of the information about Thomas Edwin Costello and Thomas Alan Levesque. They use the shorthand or the acronym. Costello is always TEC and Tal is always TAL. They kind of uses that with the different people who are putting out the whole story. And these were basically folks Tal was feeding information to over the years. But as far as specifically looking into if Thomas Costello ever actually existed, Gabe Valdez looked into that pretty painstakingly, and he could find no evidence whatsoever that there was ever a dude named Thomas Edwin Castella. But in the lore and throughout the community, you'll still have people to this day bringing up him as the great whistleblower who was part of the Dulce War, who was silenced and later disappeared. And it's the same story that what's his name picked up on. God, I'm having trouble with names these days. The other
No, I
Dulce
hear you.
bass whistleblower that got
Oh,
his
Phil
name,
Schneider?
Phil Schneider,
Yeah.
basically modeled it on that Castello story.
Why do you think, because like, the way you do put it, map it out in your book, a lot of this stuff goes back to Talavesque. Why was he so dead set on creating this myth? Like, what is it about underground bases in like the Archuleta Mesa or Dulce or whatever that would make someone want to like create this giant myth that endures? I'm always curious because like, is he associated with the military? Is he not? Like, what is his deal?
Part of his deal was he was well, interested in a lot of these topics going way back, but he was a fan of Richard Shaver growing up and really got became a believer, promoter of the Shaver's mysteries, which is a whole different deal. But that there's a whole underground world existing with these creatures called the Deros, these evil entities that were originally space people that came to Earth. And so the Shaver mysteries became a big deal, during the 40s and 50s in the Amazing Stories science fiction magazine, and they were presented as fact. And Tal became a fan of those, and actually became friends with Richard Shaver. There's an audio interview of Tal and Richard Shaver from the 1970s. I have so he was friends and a promoter and a believer of some of these inner earth mysteries. And he and his wife Mary Martin in the 70s put out a zine called the Hollow Earth Hassle. And so he was totally into all this. And why did he help create the myth? He seemed like he was pushing the myth into the technological age with the different elements he was bringing into the story, bringing the Shaver mysteries kind of up to date and presenting it in a way that would kind of capture the imagination of a new generation, the X-Files. Generation. Was he trying to make money off this? He was involved at different times with different television productions, but I think and kind of as a behind the scenes player and promoting this mythos in different ways. But I think he was more interested in just creating this narrative and providing his own truth or his own alternate truth that there was, these mystery underground bases going on with entities that lived under there that really, in Tal's mind, weren't necessarily extraterrestrial, but I think he saw that as a way to promote his story by bringing in that extraterrestrial element into it all. And aside from that, I guess Norio Hayakawa talked to Tal's sister, and she said Tal had problems. Psychological problems, that kind of stemmed around his belief in the Shaver mysteries. And so there's that element playing in there as well, that there's some psychological problems that he was dealing with.
Yeah, I could totally understand that and totally could see that in.
I don't know if I have a real answer to your
Yeah, no.
question of why he helped create this alternate universe, but a lot of people are into creating alternate realities these days.
And a lot of it surprisingly centers around underground things. Like, yeah, you've got the Shaver mysteries, you've got the inner earth stuff, the Robert Byrd stuff, and
Well, it's flowed into a QAnon thing,
yes, it has. And I think that's the impetus for doing this entire big series in the first place is because this stuff can get way out of hand. And we have seen especially with like theories about reptilians, we are seeing people acting on that now. We are seeing the guy that detonated that bomb on Christmas morning in Tennessee, he believed in reptilians. There was like one woman a few years ago who murdered her husband over reptilian conspiracies, and I'm pretty sure there was somebody that proclaimed to believe in reptilians that was involved in January 6th. So it's like
Oh, yeah.
these things keep like coming back, and like it really is interesting to see how the Shaver, because I firmly believe it was a lot of the Shaver mystery has influenced not just the Dulce Underground base stuff, but it has influenced the David Icke's crap on reptilians and stuff, because there is that kind of element to it of like,
Well,
you
there are
know.
these demonic entities that can appear human. So that's a way of demonizing a group of people.
Yeah, and especially when you tie in the protocols of the Elders of Zion into that, which has become this monster of a document that has been used by so many people to, kill Jewish people, which is fucked up. Crazy fucked up. It's so that's one thing I'd like to get into is like how these theories present themselves today, Do you see like this disclosure community? Do you think they're capable of doing their own kind of January 6th if they don't get the information that they want? Because that's one thought I've had. It's like
Ooh.
just give it, and I know it's a controversial one. I know we're going places now. We're getting into areas that are gonna piss some people off, but given how extreme
Well,
right wing they can get,
there's a faction that are, talking about getting more militant now. Seemed like Jeremy Corbell, was he the one who said that in the recent comments? We need to, this is like, don't remember his words exactly, but we're gonna get in a civil war here if we don't, goddamn government, don't start providing the truth about the aliens.
And not only
So
that,
yeah.
he was there at that hearing the other day. So like, yeah.
There's always been kind of you got a lot of different people attracted to the UFO subject, but there's always been a kind of right-wing element to some of the factions and groups involved. It's not really always quite evident, or they don't make it evident, but there's definitely that undercurrent early on with when the QAnon stuff started breaking through. I was paying a lot of attention to it, and there were forays early on with QAnon. And some of the stuff that was coming out by the different QAnon influencers to kind of put the UFO topic into all the other stuff that were in the QAnon basket. Didn't seem like it was always successful, but it's always been there. And some of the influencers also overlapped into ufology, you know. And so it's like a tool in a toolbox, I think, that can be used once again just to sow dissension and discord. Not to say, you know, the government doesn't hide this shit from us, but you know, are they really hiding aliens and crashed UFOs? I don't know about that, but that's at the heart of what is getting a lot of these people riled up in ufology these days. And that's a key part of it, that once again, I mentioned earlier that Grush brought out that he has heard from somebody. I think we can cut guess who some of those somebodies are, that you know, he has knowledge of these crash retrievals that are being hidden from us. And if the government would only release them, we, you know, according to others, we'd have free energy and everything would be rosy in the world. But no, the man is keeping us down.
Yeah, it's a tale as old as time, you know, like people have been waiting on this disclosure for how long now? For decades at this point, and it seems like every year
I
comes.
do see people on the UFO fringe getting more militant, yeah. Where that will lead, but when you start getting people stoked up at that, yeah, we saw what happened with January 6th. You being lied to. This election was stolen from you. It's like you're being lied to by the about the aliens.
Yeah, and I think one element to that that did come from, you know, this 1980s UFO disinformation age was Bill Cooper. And Bill Cooper, he went down in a blaze of gl I wouldn't call it glory, it was a blaze of stupidity, but he was kind of one of those factors, and he kind of represents how that can get out of control and how that can lead to a more militant way of thinking, and has influenced I think the strangest influence the man had though was on the Wu-Tang Clan. I didn't really see that happening, you know, but it did. What were your And I'm curious to hear what your reactions were when you first heard about David Grush's admissions about all this stuff in the debrief, because it just seemed, you know, like they were rushing to get this kind of stuff out. They weren't necessarily doing the best process vetting. I know they vetted like a couple of people that were, you know, said he was on the up and up and stuff like that. But I was curious, what your thoughts were on those admissions when they came out in early June.
Well, the debrief I've seen as a conduit for basically for a while now, this type of stuff that seems to be coming from the same faction of folks, Elizondo, whoever, you know, they talk about their unidentified sources, but the more you look into it, it's pretty clear type of access journalism that's going on there. And so I saw, you know, the Grush story is tied in with the same group of people, Keane and whoever tried to sell, you know, sell this latest version to New York Times or Washington Post, etc., who weren't biting. Once bitten, twice shy. I think, you know, New York Times got duped the first time. So, I mean, when it's the same group of people promoting the same narratives, I'm highly dubious. And you had a similar situation with this whistleblower complaint or IG complaint when you dug into what was behind Elizondo's IG complaint, you see more like of a disgruntled employee who's under investigation for something. He admitted as much in his complaint. So what's going on with Grush? I'm dubious. We need a lot more information to find out. And during the hearing, which seemed highly orchestrated, by the different people in Congress who brought these guys in. Anytime it got to real questions about, well, where did you get this information? How can we learn what's the deal? Where are these, whatever, where are they at? Who, what, where, when? Give us the aliens. It's like, well, we can discuss that in a classified setting. Any question, that probed a little deeper, he said he wasn't able to answer it there. And that's exactly what, I think the people in Congress that were pushing this Burchett lunatic expected. They knew what that answer was going to be because they, as they admitted, they already talked to him. So this was a lot of, performance to push that narrative. He's, and once again, he said he discussed this in a classified setting, but you might have noticed, and I just saw bits and pieces of the thing. Burchett was saying, oh, we didn't, they won't allow us to use the skiff today, So I don't think that ever happened afterwards in a class. And Burchett, I mean, he organized this thing, so that's no damn excuse. You set up the skiff beforehand, you have all that dialed in. So I, and you got Corbel and Knapp there.
Yep, there was a nice picture of everybody. I think Jason Colavito
And no, that's not James Clapper.
tweeted out. Oh man.
And that's how, people just there, that was getting pushed, that was James Clapper. And if you saw the guy from a distance or whatever, didn't look too, okay, that's James Clapper's bald head and his ears kind of stick out. And I go, what? And started looking for some actual photos. I'm like, oh, that ain't fucking James Clapper. But you know how these things start. So a lot of people believe, yeah, James Clapper was there. It's the real deal.
It's
I don't know what to make of it, really. I don't believe this guy Grush, but I could be wrong.
I mean, we could always be wrong, but there's always something when someone says, "Hey, someone else showed me a document that said this. Someone else showed me this." And he's basically talking about the same stuff that has been parroted since the 1980s. Only this time you get an added, like, Nazi UFO crash retrieval, added into the mix. And now you see Leslie Kane just like backpedaling, saying, "Oh, well, we didn't agree to that. We would have included that." And I'm like, "Yeah, you didn't include that, but you still included a story that in the main, part of your article said, hey, the US government has a crash retrieval program. That's in there. So what do you expect the people to think, that they aren't aliens or something?" And I think that's one of the biggest gripes that I have with this disclosure movement, is I don't think those people care about national security or like foreign weapons in their skies. Give me the damn aliens. That's what they want. So like that's
And besides what Grush, his little twist on the thing, that he's saying he has knowledge or has been told about the crash retrieval program, nothing else was really new. You had Fravor, who had the one experience, and make what you will of the Tic Tac video, but it's just another video, they kind of asked him, well, what's the deal here? Why should we be concerned about this? And he said something to the effect, well, if our adversaries can get hold of this technology, they can turn it around and use it on us. And I was like, okay, whatever, dude. I mean, and then who's the other guy, Graves? I mean, once again, he had one experience, right? And these were back a number of years ago, and there's the videos that may or may not, whatever, prove one thing or another. And so, yeah.
I mean, it's all been done before. And I mean, it was done 5 years earlier with Luis
But this is
Elizondo.
being presented as historic. This hearing was historic.
Yeah, it was historic, even though we've had like encounter people have had encounters like reported encounters with aliens for years, but it's historic. And that's the strangest thing to me. And like the one thing that I think about when I think about the 2017 article is like it seemed to hit the reset button on the entire field. Like it set it down to zero. Like there were UFOs that didn't exist before 2004. There were no other UFOs. And it's just like, hey, let's start from scratch. And it almost seems like a fantasy version of like, hey, how do we do this if we didn't have this baggage behind us of all the stuff that doesn't make ufology look good? And we're still dealing with that. So, Adam, thank you so much for joining me for this like this absolute foray into UFO disinformation and like it's been a joy. What do you got going on now? What kind of projects do you have going on now? If you could tell us about any of them, and where can people find you on the internet?
I wish I could tell you about a couple projects I'm working on, but then I'd have to kill you. Sorry.
I
No,
mean,
I am working on another book that is kind of UFO related, but I don't want to. And yeah, another secret surprise project. Just recently put out a book that I basically edited of the lost writings of James Shelby Downard called Stalking the Great Horror. So that's the latest book, and that's a whole nother thing, the life and times of James Shelby Downard. But to find out more about me, if they're interested in the books, go to Amazon. All my books are there. I have an adamgorightly.com website. I have a UFO related website called Chasing UFOs, so people can find out more. I'm on Twitter, so those are some of the outlets.
Yes, and you are definitely one of the you're a great follow on Twitter, and I enjoy your tweets. So definitely go follow Adam on Twitter. Buy his books. His books are fantastic. I think it was Steve Berg that actually put me onto your books to begin with.
Oh,
So
cool, yeah.
yeah. So definitely, and if you're interested in all this, like if you have any kind of passing interest in like these UAP hearings and stuff like that, go pick up Saucer Spooks and Kooks and read through it, and you will see that this stuff is not new. It's very old, it's very
Yeah.
recycled. Thank you again, man, for joining me. This has been fantastic.
Great. Thanks, Rob.